Now everything seems to be working, and we can start our public examination of the dissertation of Tiffany. We do have some adjustments to the normal procedure because of the technical problems we are facing here. Yesterday everything went well. Tervetuloa sekä täällä seminaarin vanhassa juhlasalissa että etäyhteyden päässä seuraamaan kasvatustieteen maisteri Tiffany Mijanon Higher Education and Global Social Injustice julkista tarkastustilaisuutta. Welcome everybody, both here in Seminarium, Jyväskylä, Finland, and over Zoom to the public defense of Master of Education, Tiffany Mijanon's doctoral dissertation, Higher Education and Global Social Injustice. She will attend the defense online from Portland, United States. Vastaajaväittäjänä meillä on professori Elina Lehtomäki Oulun yliopistosta. The opponent is Professor Elina Lehtomäki from the University of Oulu, Finland. Koska väitöstilaisuus striimataan, pyydän niitä yleisön jäseniä, joilla on huomautettavaa Mijanon väitöskirjan johdosta, ottamaan yhteyttä tiedotteessa mainittuun puhelinnumeroon väitöstilaisuuden lopulla. As the defense is streamed, I would like to ask those who have questions about Mijanon's dissertation to contact me in the phone number in the defense announcement. Muistutan myös turvaetäisyyksien pitämisestä tilaisuuden aikana ja sen jälkeen. I would also like to remind everybody about distancing during and after the defense because of the pandemic we are facing. Jyväskylän yliopiston kasvatustieteiden ja psykologian tiedekunnan määräämänä kustoksena julistan väitöstilaisuuden alkaneeksi. As the custos appointed by the Faculty of Education and Psychology, I declare this public examination opened. Now, Tiffany, it's your turn.
Thank you. Okay. Sami people, distinguished custos, honored opponent, other respected members of the audience, let us hear the words of American activist John Lewis. When you see something is not right, you must say something. You must do something. Ordinary people with extraordinary vision can redeem the soul of America by getting in what I call good trouble, necessary trouble. You must also study and learn the lessons of history, because humanity has been involved in this soul-wrenching existential struggle for a very long time. People on every continent have stood in your shoes through decades and centuries before you. Continue to build union between movements stretching across the globe. We must put away our willingness to profit from the exploitation of others. These cannot be dismissed as only political statements. These statements are supported by an immense body of scientific literature. The findings of this dissertation suggest that as scientists, teachers, researchers, leaders, humans, we must stop pretending that research and advocacy are not related. We must stop pretending that those within the ivory tower are not responsible for injustice. On this day, as we consider if I should join the ranks of fully qualified academics, I will use this time to honor my responsibility to research, teaching, and service. In this research, I suggest that geographically bound and ahistorical nature of modern justice frames has led practitioners at institutions of higher education to perpetuate global injustice. Neoliberalism illuminates some of the mechanisms of exclusion by which these actors operate, but it is not complete. History did not begin with the accelerated age of globalization in which we developed neoliberal critique. Essentially ahistorical, neoliberal theory alone lacks woefully important historical context of colonization. To understand global justice, we cannot conveniently omit that the modern world has been constructed on an unequal playing field that exploited others. The structures that we have created on this field are therefore unequal and exploitative. The power lines by which we discriminate access are very similar to those that were constructed during the conquest of the Americas. Neoliberalism exaggerates, but these injustices stem from colonialism. So I say again, let us hear the words of John Lewis. You must study and learn the lessons of history, because humanity has been involved in this soul-wrenching existential struggle for a very long time. Although the current individuals within privileged countries may not have been involved in the direct colonization of other countries, their continued reliance on these borders to restrict and bestow rights is an example of the ways in which those who have inherited power continue to directly benefit from the inequity created by colonization. In maintaining exclusive systems justified on the basis of these borders, the historical advantage of colonizers and those aligned with colonizers is preserved. This is quite clear in the case of the US, where we have documented colonization relatively extensively. This is also true in countries outside of the US. Finland, though not often identified as a colonized or colonizing country itself, has been able to reap the benefits of colonization through association with historical colonizers. The ideological inclusion of Finland within what many call the global North has manifested as institutional inclusion and economic privilege. For example, Finland has been a part of the EU since the 1990s because Finland shares currency, legal regulations, and institutions with other member states of the EU, the success of Finland is inextricably linked to the success of colonizing member states. So I say again, let us hear the words of John Lewis. People on every continent have stood in your shoes through decades and centuries before you. Continue to build union between movements stretching across the globe, because we must put away our willingness to profit from the exploitation of others. When we consider our global historical foundations, then we must recognize that despite our espoused liberal ideas, these institutions of higher education were not built to perpetuate social justice. Nonetheless, as humans that maintain these institutions, we can and should work to advance the mission of social justice. There is a tension here. Attention that is revealed in my work and the work of other critical internationalization scholars. In this dissertation, I discuss a theoretical population essentially overlooked by higher education scholarship, asymmetrically represented education seekers, ARIES. ARIES are potential international students from low socioeconomic status backgrounds, low-income countries, or underrepresented lower middle-income countries that wish to study at an institution of higher education in which many refer to as the global north. Through the lens of coloniality, I demonstrate how a history of colonization has created the conditions by which we justify the exclusion of ARIES. I reveal that our inability to include ARIES in the conversation perpetuates global social injustice. In this dissertation, I identified the ways in which practitioners run into ontological and ideological barriers to social justice that are associated with the inclusion of these ARIES at their institutions. In the case of the others, my co-authors and I identified the international access paradox. ARIES were excluded from access to the community colleges in the study by virtue of price discrimination, International leaders first crafted a class of privileged international students and then justified discrimination for all potential international students on the basis of that manufactured privilege. Aries were ideologically invisible to the leaders. In Global Responsibility in Finland, I found many of my participants framed global responsibility, including responsibility to international students, in a critical or liberal frame, but others allowed neoliberalism to co-opt the term. Moreover, those that promoted a critical liberal frame often believed themselves relatively powerless to promote globally responsible actions, despite their own personal beliefs. In thinking globally about social justice, I detailed the ways in which the definition of humanism can be manipulated by the wielder to actually dissuade the pursuit of global social justice. I assert that to shape our institutions to avoid perpetuating global social injustice, it is not enough to be humanist. It is not enough to be liberal. It is not even enough to be critical if that criticality is confined within national borders. As such, across my work, I illuminate that institutional members struggle to reconcile their own desire to do good within an unjust system and within an unjust frame of reference. Perhaps that is because the system was not designed for that purpose. But that does not mean that we should throw it away and start over. How could we do that? Could we do that? What is the way forward? And that is what we're discussing within the subfield of critical internationalization studies. In this dissertation, I argue that grounding our actions in philosophy allows us to suggest concrete solutions. In my experience, there are many doctors of philosophy that seem to have forgotten the role that philosophy plays in our research and practice. It is from this philosophical foundation that I offer a new frame that helps to enable practitioners to hold each other accountable for our exploitative relationships with internationalization. The critical humanist rationale. In accordance with Jung's 2006 social connections model, given that we participate in and benefit from a system that has created the conditions by which injustice is perpetuated, we therefore have a responsibility to mediate this injustice. Jung asserts that this responsibility for injustice can only be discharged through collective action. But do not forget that I have created in this the knowledge that I have created in this dissertation is not new to the world. It is new to the academy. It is very important that you understand what I have done in this dissertation. What I have done is bring this information to your attention in a way that is palatable to the hegemony and caters to white fragility. Marginalized peoples have been telling the world of their oppression for a very long time, but we have not wanted to hear. Importantly, we have not fostered educational institutions capable of facilitating listening. At this time in history, many of us fundamentally believe, with great conviction and formalized education to support this conviction, that we are hearing, when we have never actually been educated enough to listen. This education does not come from the academy. So I will return to the words of John Lewis. When you see something is not right, you must say something. You must do something. You must also study and learn. Continue to build union between movements stretching across the globe. To do this, we must make social justice in higher education a global conversation. We must seek knowledge from outside the academy to allow us to reshape the academy itself. We must listen to the voices of the oppressed, seek understanding from the lived experiences of those who are not academics, seek understanding that has not been filtered through the lens of the hegemony that is traditional research methods. So instead, let me tell you a story of collective action, service, in which I recently participated in Portland, Oregon. On July 19th, I was physically attacked by my government, the government of the United States. On this night, mothers of my city stood arm in arm to protect the rights of protesters associated with the Black Lives Matter movement. We had learned that federal agents had been deployed to attack nonviolent protesters as terrorists. Well aware of our privilege as mothers, predominantly white mothers, when it comes to police interaction, we came to use this privilege to shield our fellow protesters. We stood arm in arm with peace signs, baby blankets, and flowers. There can be no confusion about if we were terrorists. That is to say that the implicit bias of the officers could not be used as an excuse to absolve them of their crimes. Standing up against oppression is not easy work. Many sustained injuries so severe that they were hospitalized. The long-term effects of the gas on the bodies of women is not researched, but we felt its toxic effects. Nevertheless, this is nothing compared to the abuses that have been perpetrated upon Black lives. This is nothing compared to the murder of Breonna Taylor by police officers in her own home. Nothing compared to the public lynching of George Floyd. Nothing compared to the slaughter of Black children like Trayvon Martin. On this night, some might say that some of my privilege was suspended when police and federal officers turned their non-lethal weapons on me. Though I believe it impossible to truly suspend privilege, I mention this to make a point. Despite my privileged position in society, when I aligned myself with those who had been disprivileged, when I called out injustice of the hegemony, I too became the target of aggression to which I was previously immune. Colleagues, I ask you to understand this point because it is a very important lesson for academics in this time of nationalism and populism. As scholars, we have occupied a privileged place in society. We have maintained this privilege by choosing not to pursue lines of inquiry that would yield results that would challenge the hegemony. We have maintained this privileged position by pretending that research and institutions of higher education are value neutral. My work and the work of other critical scholars demonstrates that we are not. We have long positioned ourselves on the side of the aggressors so as to continue to bolster our privilege along with theirs. As we begin to position ourselves in opposition to the hegemony with greater collective action, instead of tools to prop up the hegemony, we will feel as if some of our privilege has been suspended. We have observed this recently, particularly in the US. Leaders continue to deny expert opinion informed by science. Universities are being demonized as liberal institutions that corrupt youth. Climate change is described as a hoax. In July, four former heads of the US Center for Disease Control asserted that this willful discreditation of scientific expertise was the fundamental reason that the US was a world leader in deaths from COVID-19. Some have suggested that it is critical scholarship that has brought about this distrust in science. This is no more true than suggesting that it was nonviolent mothers with baby blankets that brought physical abuse on themselves. We are only reflecting your own biases back at you. When we provide you the opportunity to see your reflection, there is the opportunity for growth and change. In that moment, you have an opportunity to choose your values over your hubris. Will you take this opportunity? Or will you lash out at the mirror? Will you continue to claim that it is not you? Will you turn away? If critical theory will be the downfall of the academy, then let the academy fall. Because if truth is what crumbles the ivory tower, then it was not built on a strong enough foundation to begin with. Because the lives of the systematically oppressed matter, Black lives matter. And their lives are literally on the line every day. When we allow the knowledge that we constructed to be used for injustice, then we are complicit. When we construct this knowledge in a system that facilitates injustice, then we are complicit. This is not value-neutral work. We cannot continue to sit in an ivory tower and ignore our responsibilities for the injustices that we are facilitating. We have a global responsibility. That said, if we take up this responsibility, it is unlikely that the Academy will fall. To return to the story of Portland, when privileged white moms stood strong and united with other protesters against the hegemony, when we wielded our privilege to begin to claim our responsibility for injustice night after night, others with privilege joined us. Fathers, teachers, veterans, first responders joined us physically. Ideologically, people from around the world have begun to join us. But let us not forget that this knowledge has been here since before this event. This particular physical movement had existed 50 plus nights before the night that I described. And ideological seeds are much, much older. The Black Lives Matter protest continues with them. The Black Lives Matter protests continue, and with them, so does the awakening of the minds of privileged people all over the world. But why has it taken so many, so long to even begin to awaken? The most important finding of my work is that there are many well-intentioned practitioners and scholars that believe themselves to already be engaged in positive action, when in actuality, they are perpetuating global social injustice. For this too, we can learn from the BLM movement with roots in critical race scholarship. Some tips: educate yourself, listen to Black voices, get comfortable with being uncomfortable, focus on equity and not equality, be open to critique, but not every opinion is valid nor equal. Education is a gift, silence is violence. The most important battle is within ourselves. Get your people. There are many highly educated people in this room, but you are not as educated as you think if you do not deeply understand these statements. You are not as educated as you think if you do not recognize your own fragility when you resist these statements. We must continue to seek knowledge about how we can wield our privilege in the pursuit of social justice that will not inadvertently derail our goal. And we must be prepared to make mistakes and correct those mistakes. This means first recognizing that we are very educated people that are simultaneously very ignorant. It is only by learning from the voices of the disempowered and through engaging in purposeful collective action that we can be successful knowledge disseminators ourselves. As I have said in this dissertation, as a scientific community and as practitioners of higher education, we must engage in collective action. No member of an institution of higher education can individually discharge their responsibility to address injustice. When you ignore this responsibility, you exacerbate the risk and harm to the oppressed and your colleagues that are trying to honor their responsibility. Educate yourself and encourage others to become educated. This is a lifelong process. As a Fulbright scholar, I was often asked to speak about what Finland can learn from the US. I would not advise imitating a system built on mass genocide and slavery. I would not advise imitating a system that continues to find strategic and insidious ways to oppress its peoples. I must tell you this because my silence on this would not, as John Lewis says, work to redeem the soul of America. Unfortunately, while in Finland, my research showed that Finland was already adopting US strategy by allowing neoliberalism to creep into their institutions of higher education. In this dissertation, I have primarily tried to instead highlight what the U.S. could learn from Finland as a way of dissuading you from making this terrible mistake of imitating the oppressive structures of the U.S. Nonetheless, what I hope that I have taught you in this speech is that the soul of Finland is not free from responsibility from historical oppression that manifests as modern-day injustices. No individual in any country is free from this responsibility. For this reason, Finland has much to learn from the U.S. Finland should learn from our critical scholars, our activists, our protesters. Although we are home to many of the world's leading experts, oppression is not unique to the U.S. The context shifts, but the lessons are the same. In many ways, we could conceptualize Finland as a nation blinded by privilege. So do not allow Finland to be a haven for racism, nationalism, and xenophobia that we have observed in Turku. So I provide you one last opportunity to learn by truly hearing the words of John Lewis. When you see something is not right, you must say something. You must do something. You must also study and learn the lessons of history, because humanity has been involved in this soul-wrenching existential struggle for a very long time. People on every continent have stood in your shoes through decades and centuries before you. Continue to build union between movements stretching across the globe, because we must put away our willingness to profit from the exploitation of others. John Lewis. I cannot do this work for you. Each of you have an individual responsibility to educate yourselves and apply this education to your particular cultural, institutional, and individual contexts. This will require first recognizing our own ignorance. And that is perhaps the greatest battle as academics and humans. But you will be unsuccessful if you cannot first unlearn your assumptions of innocence and benevolence. This will require a deep understanding of equity rather than equality. And I will leave you with my advice, though I cannot claim ownership. As you continue your education and your collective action, stand strong and stand united when your privilege is challenged by the hegemony. Do not falter in your responsibility simply when you glimpse what disprivilege looks like. It should serve as a reminder of why we do the work, why it is necessary to do this work. This should be an indication that you are in the right kind of trouble, good and necessary trouble. John Lewis. And then honored Professor Lehtomäki, as the opponent appointed by the faculty, please present the comments that you see my dissertation has given grounds for. Sorry, Professor, I can't hear. I think you're on mute.
Good. Let's start again. No.
It is a bit echoey.
Yes, it is echo here, so I have to wait for it. Yes. Okay. We still have some echoing in this hall. Just a moment. Okay. Yes, now I think it works better. Can you hear me well?
Yes.
Yes, good. So I would like to thank the faculty for this opportunity to read thoroughly through the doctoral dissertation, and it's my pleasure to discuss it here today. And I think the topic is certainly highly relevant in these times of crisis, not only because of Portland, Oregon, but also because of the pandemic and crises that we, according to researchers, from several disciplines, we are going to face even more crises in the future. So we are practicing how to deal with crises, global connections through crises as well. So we are actually challenging also high education institutions, and that is why this discussion on social justice in the global scale, global social justice and injustice, as well as social connections model, are timely today, more than ever before, I would guess, even though philosophers, as you have stated in the thesis, have discussed this justice and global social justice and social connections over decades. And in this dissertation, the philosophical grounding is the starting point, which I consider very important. And I think the philosophical grounding and notions defined by Martha Nussbaum, for instance, on social justice and roles on social justice, and then working on Jung's perception of how these social connections are actually ways to enact on injustices, I think form a very sort of strong foundation for the thesis. And the thesis promises new novel knowledge in the field of critical higher education research. And it does so. It focuses on responsibility. It focuses on actors, decision makers in higher education, and more precisely administrative actors, those who have something to say, but also have the position to enact on issues within the higher education institutions. Yet the higher education institutions are selected purposefully, and it is, I think, well justified as well that community colleges in the US, which do have a mission to fight against social injustice, are selected, and then institutions in Finland, which also promote, as they define themselves, global responsibility. And these are, I think, the key issues here, and we are talking about here two privileged countries, high-income countries, which a high degree of welfare, still both with pockets of poverty, still both with inequalities. And I think something that we are going to discuss soon is also what are the pockets of poverty, what are the pockets of injustices in these two countries, both countries. And I think when I was reading the thesis, the issue that really invited me to continue and read is also the questions. How do the administrators articulate? How do they see these issues? What do they think? How do they position themselves in the discussion, in the dialogue? What can they do within their institutions, but also globally? And in this dissertation, the focus has been on the other hand, on international, on one hand, on international students and the number of international students, and how their administrative actors or leaders discuss internationalization and international students' participation in their education systems. And then also then cartographies, how you map and how these things are connected and justified by the leaders. And these are, I think, the important elements here in the thesis that I would like to highlight. And that I think the significance comes really from the perspective on these issues. And in the thesis, Tiffany Vigiano has really clearly emphasized the importance of having multiple perspectives or multiple knowledges, bringing different voices into the picture. Not only listening, but also questioning and asking further questions in the dissertation. And these are, I think, the clear strength of the thesis. And I think we'll go further and discuss then how the thesis has been conducted, how the data has been analyzed, because there are, I think, issues that I would like to know a little bit more about. And I would like to still congratulate that I think the thesis is highly relevant and timely at the moment, and think about Portland, Oregon, and the pictures from Portland, Oregon at the moment. And on top of that, we have the crisis that we are all affected globally, and that is one of the reasons why we have become more digitalized and working online and having the idea of connectedness. But what does this connectedness bring to us? Does it bring the stronger neoliberal approaches? Does it emphasize more the national borders, or can we reach beyond that, as suggested in your dissertation, that we do reach and collaborate also across the globe? But with these words, I would like to go further and ask some questions and some clarifications related to the thesis. And my first question comes to the theory of justice and also Jung's model of social connections. And I would like to ask you, what led you to apply this model? What were the initial influencing ideas? Where do they come from? Why did you get interested in the social connection model?
That's a wonderful question. Thank you. Actually, I was interested in that model because while I was studying in Finland, I had conversations relating to these issues with a colleague, Bernardo Sfado, and he actually sent me the article based on our conversations. And I think it's actually a nice story as it relates to these larger points, because he was from Brazil studying in Finland, and that was where we met and where he shared his knowledge with me that made it possible for me to reconceptualize this work that has global implications. But I suppose your question was probably less about the person who gave me the information, but my work is actually very much about making it personal. So it, in my answer, I'm also reflecting that importance. It is important to remember that we are people, we are humans, and these connections, these social connections, are what give us our these responsibilities. And so that's mirrored in Jung's work. And for that reason, I think that was what really stuck out to me.
And that led you also to talk about, just one moment, we have to check the echo in here again. Yes, and that also has led you further to discover also the continuum, as we would call neoliberal dimensions within the internationalization of higher education, and you claim that this research is really a contribution to the critical internationalization studies. And in the critical internationalization studies, you have carefully studied especially Stein, but also Andreotti and others. And you consider yourself to belong to this, I would assume, not to the soft, but more to the critical strand of the critical internationalization scientific community. Do I understand it correctly?
I think, as I highlight in the dissertation, I think that there is there's more variance in soft critique than it was currently at the time, and probably still today is discussed. So there are these three kind of rigid categories that we must fall into if we accept one principle or another, but I think that, so soft critique actually is more of a continuum, and I think a lot of soft critique is too soft, but I also think that we need some amount of soft critique to be able to actually reach practitioners who are doing the work and make it tangible and relevant and important to them. Just saying over and over again that we're in a broken system that we're isn't really going to help us move forward. So for that reason, I think that the work that I do sometimes falls into soft critique, but it's purposeful soft critique.
And you have selected two different contexts, the US and the Finnish higher education institutions with a specific mission. And they have articulated these institutions in their strategies and policies that they have this good intention, as you mentioned in the dissertation, that there are many administrators and institutions with good intentions. And did you already set as an aim then when you started the research? Now we go far back and before, or did the aim come along the process? You have had this flexible approach in your research, as you say, that you have sort of used the methods that have been appropriate depending on the context, depending on the process, having this sort of fluid or flexible approach. What did the aim come already in the beginning that you wanted to look at their articulations, or did it come along when you started with the first paper that focuses on the US context? And the overall aim, I would like to know how the overall aim came about.
Yeah, I think that I am understanding your question correctly. So I'll answer and then feel free to follow up. The beginnings of this research started when I had just begun graduate school, and I was working with critical race scholars and trying to learn about critical research from that framework. And then on my own, trying to figure out how this related to international studies. At that time, there was not as much critical internationalization literature, and I was trying to figure out that relationship. I had a sense that they were related, but I was in graduate school and still learning. And so then I was working with John Levin, who is not a critical scholar, and trying to navigate what it means to work, to try to do critical work within a liberal frame. And so that's kind of where I think the first paper deviates a little bit from what I would say is my overall orientation. Was that kind of an answer to your question?
Yes, yes. And then you emphasize very much the ethical considerations. And I think these ones, to me, are always very important in such kind of research. You are looking into internationalization with a critical lens. And you clarify, I think, the ethical considerations very clearly. And you refer also to the ethical challenges that Sharon Stein has defined or identified in higher education internationalization processes, 5 ethical challenges. And then these ones you look into in these two contexts. And then how do you then combine these sort of ethical challenges if you consider the 5 ethical challenges and then relate them to your own approach? What are the ethical, or what kind of ethical challenges related, or in Stein's terms, what did you identify in your process as ethical challenges along the way while conducting the research?
Well, I'll highlight epistemic dominance. So the idea that Western knowledge is superior, that's an ethical challenge that's insurmountable if the end goal is documented research, if the end goal is where we are right now, because you have to conform to the Western frame, the Western way of conceptualizing knowledge. And when I say Western, I use this term in the sense that we understand what I say when I say Western, but recognize that that also is contributing to epistemic dominance. So even conversing about the subject, there are paradoxes that we have to navigate. So I think that's kind of one that was, that's quite prevalent and something that I work to navigate. And I think that that's the importance of the speech that I just gave. I attempted to try to step outside of Western or global North or minority world ways of understanding and learning. So
Yes, and you also have gone through some of the critique on the sort of scholars who consider themselves as being critical scholars, and including also Nussbaum and others. And you mentioned that these critical scholars, when they approach, they still stay within the elite sort of perspectives in a way, or Western, as you mentioned now. And we, as scholars, you say, we need to be very clear about our philosophical foundations. And that comes also as a finding in your research later on. You stated very early on already in the thesis, and then you emphasize that we are to reject neutrality. We are never neutral. And I think in my view, it already comes with the choice of the topic. I think that's already a choice, an ethical choice, how you select the topic. And that is what I think you have done also here. You have selected your topic with already explaining your philosophical foundation related to that. And you do discuss on decolonizing knowledge, and you do discuss in your three sub-studies, even though the contexts and the approaches have been a bit different. And then you have aimed to find these overarching issues across the three studies. The last one focuses on Finland. And then I do have a question related to the data on Finland, and also on the data on the US community colleges. These institutions with good intentions, was there anything in the interview data that was associated with racism in these contexts? I'm not thinking about Portland, Oregon, but I also think about Black Lives Matters. But in general, Finland has been identified in the European study, recent research, I think 2018, as the most racist country in Europe. And how does that, and then we see the Black Lives Matters movement in the US, and several scholars in the US discussing racism and harsh violence as well, and violation of human rights. How did this come in the interviews? Did you ask about these issues, is the first question. And then how was that responded to or articulated by the leaders or administrative actors?
Yeah, I'm thankful that you asked that question, because it's something that I think is definitely important to contextualize the research that I did. And as I mentioned in my speech, my research very much caters to white fragility, because it doesn't often call attention to the racial component. But the reason the start of that reason, that race is not included in this work, is that when I was writing this, and most of this was completed in 2018, we were not connecting critical race scholarship to critical internationalization studies yet. And as someone who is not a person of color, I was not in the position to be able to make that connection if critical race scholars were not seeing that connection. And that's part of recognizing our positionality and our privilege and not trying to speak for lived experiences that aren't our own. And so at that time, when I was learning from the critical race scholars that I worked with at UC Riverside, that was not, race was not something that they were thinking about internationally. And so that's why it's not included in the work. But then in that specific study in Finland, when I was asking these questions to the administrative actors, I wasn't asking questions about racism. I was asking very open-ended questions. Honestly, it was, what does global responsibility mean to you? Was the foundation of the question. And most of my participants would mean, what do you mean? What do you mean by global responsibility? Like, what? And try to get me to answer the question for them. So I tried my best not to ask any sort of leading questions. So I wouldn't ask something relating to racism because it would be leading them in a direction. Because the idea was to construct a definition from them and not from me. But then, yes, I do believe that racism is certainly a global issue, and that there's a lot that we can learn from the Black Lives Matter movement in the U.S. that is applicable to racism in Finland.
And could that be interpreted also as how higher education institutions are ignorant, administrators, leaders are either ignorant or avoid these kind of questions? Isn't it easier to talk about global responsibility as an ideology or policy level issue?
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you. I think that that's that point that I made in the speech, that silence is violence. So just because we're not saying something does not mean that we are supporting the opposite. You're only supporting something if you're saying something about it, and that's what it means to be an anti-racist rather than just not racist, because when you're trying to be just not racist, then you probably are being racist.
This could also be interpreted as aiming to be neutral, avoiding taking sides, don't you think so?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but this neutrality, as I say, doesn't exist. There's no such thing as neutrality. And there's this term, democratic racism, where we try to say that, you know, everyone is entitled to their opinion. And that's the beauty of democracy. But in actuality, that's racism. You're not entitled to have an opinion that is racist and say that that is democracy, but unfortunately that is the world that we exist in.
And in your research, you discuss this asymmetrically represented students, and when looking into this, you have also emphasized that, like in the US, even in these community colleges or in the US as a whole, the number of students from low-income countries is very small, 2%, and then of the student population, and then compared that to Finland, where it's 8%. And how do you interpret this issue of offering either scholarships or having students who come from low-income countries? Low-income countries, you meant, and you have referred to these international institutions' definitions. And what does this issue of having international students from low-income countries, what does it actually mean in terms of global social justice? This was one of the questions you asked the administrators, you know, about their approaches and their understanding of this asymmetrically represented students and students from low-income countries. How do you interpret this number of students from low-income countries in our northern or western institutions?
Yeah, I mean, so it goes back to colonialism to some extent. So when we're suggesting, you know, that everyone is getting equal resources, that's not the case. Everyone doesn't have equal resources. And so some privileged countries, they have more resources than other countries. And so we can conceptualize this as an issue of access. It also is problematic in that it highlights epistemic dominance. It highlights what we say is the West or the Global North or the minority worlds knowledge is important, that everyone should come and want to have this knowledge. And that's not necessarily the case. And that's not what I attempt to imply. What I suggest is that if we are going to have international students, if we are going to invite them to come to study at our universities, we should do so with the purpose of equity as best that we can, rather than creating a structure that will certainly exacerbate social injustice.
And if he interprets a situation having such small numbers in terms of global injustice and justice, on the other hand, for instance, the African Union and recently even some African scholars, including Youssef Waghid from South Africa, they have claimed also that, and Lov Kacheni, who talks about decolonizing higher education and decolonizing institutions, they do talk about also that global injustice cannot be solved simply by educating people in the North with the Western approaches. How would that seem to be changing the role of global higher education institutions or institutions that claim or aim to be having the global responsibility? How would that change their role in terms of global justice and injustice, if you think their role and purpose? Essentially, I think that your research very much focuses actually on the purpose of higher education. And you have referred to Margin Zone's research also on what is the purpose, what is the role, public common good, social good, and what about, more recently he has been talking also about global common good. How do this then relate to that global common good? How do you see that this issue of decolonizing knowledge then changes the functions or tasks of higher education institutions? If we start from community colleges, we can't maybe talk about in general in this neoliberal sort of dominant world, but we can talk about these institutions that have already articulated as having global responsibility in their strategies and policies.
So I think we should consider exchanges much more than we do, equitable exchanges. So we need, if we're thinking about issues of access, sending students from the minority world to the majority world, is one way to meet that demand, and then it makes exchange more feasible. So trying to highlight and encourage students to do that. I think that, you know, in my chapter, one thing that I highlight in that data is that at the community college, students are more likely to choose to go to countries outside of Europe. They are more likely to go to countries in South America and countries in somewhere in, I believe if I can recall the data correctly, Africa. So essentially what I argue in that piece is that that part of this issue of access also is sending students to other countries, and not just having students come to privileged countries. And that will contribute ideally to a more complete understanding of the actual state of the entire world instead of just the state of majority countries. Does that answer some of your question?
Yes, and I think we will still continue on some of the issues related to this. There's also recent research on how traveling may not change our perceptions. in the Global Irrigation Research Network, we have discussed also recent research on how exchange activities may not change people's perspectives and not increase understanding of the world if not combined with reflection. And there's evidence, for instance, there was a quite intensive a study of German students who went abroad and came back, and then those students who stayed at home and studied and reflected and discussed global issues. And the results were better for the group who stayed at home but reflected on them compared to those who went and enjoyed international mobility but actually emphasized or strengthened their stereotypes. So I would like to call a little bit more critical approach when it comes to simply thinking that mobility is the solution. I think the phenomena is more complex. What would you say?
Yeah, based, I mean, certainly.
Intentions, yes, it looks, I think, one solution, but maybe the issues or phenomena is more complex.
Yeah, no, certainly. So the nature of my work is to encourage practitioners, administrative actors, to be reflective and critical on their own actions. And so if we can't set a path for helping practitioners, administrative actors, learn to be reflective of their own actions, learn to be critical, then they won't be able to facilitate those reflections for students.
Yes, and I think your research certainly focuses on the administrators. Did you think anyway along the process when you were interviewing people, these administrators or leaders, did you consider their background, how their experiences, work experiences, or mobility, or reflection skills, or demands to reflect on their work, how do they, did they tell you about their past and how that has influenced their thinking and their approaches in relation to the university's official articulation?
Yeah, part of all of my interviews would be, you know, backstory on about them and who they are and what they do and what brought them to do this work. And so I definitely have a lot of information on that. I think one salient trend is this idea of practitioner scholar that I was in a GIS meeting earlier today, and it was brought up. But this idea of practitioner scholar that people are simultaneously practitioners, but also continuing their education, either getting their master's or their PhD, or are researchers in the field while they are serving this administrative role. And people who fit this practitioner scholar mold were more likely to be critical and reflective of their work, were more likely to recognize the ways in which the work might not be contributing to global social injustice throughout the course of our conversation. But at the same time, I think it was probably somewhat discipline specific, and the different studies that I did interviewed people from different areas for different reasons. So in Finland, when I was interviewing, internationalization actors, so people who were specifically doing something with internationalization. And I think that, you know, in that they were internationalization actors, I likely had a strong understanding of some sort of internationalization research of some kind. This is not the case for everyone, but they were more likely to do that. And when they did have some sort of understanding of internationalization literature, or at least, you know, the SDGs, they were more likely to be critical.
And then if we then look at this, some part of the results also. I think you talk about international agenda, you talk about these international organizations as well, and you also mention United Nations Sustainable Development Goals here, and you cite some researchers who are very much emphasizing that equitable education is the goal, quality education is the goal for all, and higher education institutions have this significant role. And like Marginson says also that we have this responsibility for providing the global common good and social good. And then at the same time, there are examples also of how things can be done, but this equitable education that you mentioned, you also say it's like Finland walks this tightrope of globalization and carefully avoiding the pitfalls of neoliberalism typically associated with internationalization strategy. And I think, like, yes, this tightrope is very true, I would think. I think we have these good intentions while we at the same time apply neoliberal discourses in our approaches. And what do you think influences this? You know, why are we walking this tightrope here in Finland? What are the forces behind this walk? Why is it a tightrope? This is on page 39 that you mentioned this tightrope. And I think, yes, that's very true. But what influences this situation? Why is it a tightrope? Why is Finland brave enough to walk, you know, really towards global responsibility and not only articulate, but also walk the talk? What do you think? Why is it so? What are the influencing forces there?
I think that I don't want to speak beyond my data. So I couldn't give you a strong answer to that question. But I can indicate what participants from my interviews have suggested, which often would allude to politics and government. And I think that that's the nature of higher education, because as we are global institutions, then politics come into play quite heavily. But as I said in my speech, the answers to these questions, they come from context. And someone with that has lived and worked in Finland their entire life would probably be able to give you a much better answer to that question than I could.
And if you look at the community colleges, you don't mention the tightrope with them. How much freedom do they have, actually, the administrators, leaders, to work the way they wish?
I don't think that they at the U.S. Community College of the participants in my study, I don't think that they strove to walk a tightrope. I think that they did not recognize that there was a reason to try to walk the tightrope. In the U.S., the neoliberalism is the logic of the land. So to step outside that logic is quite difficult. Whereas I suppose in Finland, it is not necessarily the law of the land. So it's easier to critique because it hasn't permeated every aspect of life yet.
And I would think funding is an issue, and you have said that, you know, the scope of this research could not cover issues like funding schemes and such. Yet you do talk about the international agreements, you do talk about international cooperation, you mention also European Union and for instance, International Association of Universities and issues like that. And this international collaboration is now challenged because of the pandemic, for instance, but it's also challenged because of neoliberal approaches. where emphasis is on the benefits for the institution, you know, at the cost of global responsibility, at the cost of public common good. How do you then see that these macro strategies that you also talk about in the analyzing and coding phases, you also used Van Leeuwen's and Bodak's macro strategies. And I think you mentioned also they're useful for critically analyzing discourses or discourse, and to have the power to explain the ways in which people rationalize exclusion and inclusion. And how would you like to explain how you use the macro strategies and how that added? Because I understood you had this flexible approach, and what made you then to apply the macro strategy approach at this stage? You have used that in some study one already.
Yeah, so I use them as a way of, as you say, analyzing language, justifications. So in sub-study one, we were attempting to really understand the rationalization and the root of the rationalization. And so by analyzing, by breaking down these justifications, we were able to identify really what exactly this root of justification was, which led us to be able to see this international access paradox, which we may not have been able to identify without breaking into pieces these rationales.
And to me, it seems like, you know, these community colleges that have this good intentions, as you state, they had more freedom to function as they wish. And I think that that seems clear to me. And then at the same time, they were very, very much concerned still about their own students and not so about the global issues. And then if you then look at in sub-study two, you had this theoretical explanation as your approach. And what you found in the sub-study two was that you draw also on the social theory, justice theory, and you imagine, as you say, the global humanistic rationale to study abroad. Again, this is much more concerned about study abroad approaches. And how would you then, you said you were guided by Vanessa Andreotti and her colleagues' work on these paradigms of discourse. Would you please explain a bit how these paradigms of discourse helped you to explain the ways this scholarship has been applied?
Yeah, I think I have a useful chart in there. Maybe it's useful. I think it's useful.
Yes.
So the chart kind of breaks down when we're talking about humanism, how humanism can be actually manipulated based on these different ideas of neoliberalism, liberalism, and criticality can actually make humanism mean something very different to different people. So you could be using the same word, and assuming that you're pursuing the same goal or the same objective, but in actuality you're not. So the objective from a neoliberal perspective might be revenue generation for individual students that would contribute to the US GDP. So from a liberal perspective, the objective might be to prepare citizens to participate in democratic society. But in a critical perspective, it's to mitigate injustice. And then I add that from a critical international perspective, it's to mitigate global injustice. Because in my work with my colleagues and other work with my my colleagues, we identified that the target population at community colleges, those that they view most deserving of open access or of resources for support, will shift based on how they conceptualize their community. And so if we are attempting to mediate in global injustice, we can't just think critically, we have to think critically, but also internationally. And so within that triangle, we see that definitions change, but also even in just the critical piece, the definition changes.
And you use the term the illusion of open access in substudy one, and that is one of the final findings of that that substudy. And you mentioned here that at all the three colleges, the recruitment of international students was primarily a response to economic arguments, and so it was economic arguments and economic gain still for the colleges. And then in one of them, the president says that instead of individual students coming, they would also like to have, commissioned degrees and studies by governments. And this is what is mentioned here. And then if you look at this in the global injustice, and you look at the internationalization processes going on, that you have now followed, also the recent research, what happens with our internationalization. We are, even in Finland, more interested in paying customers. And this illusion of open access, I think this is an important finding also in terms of community college mission. Their mission and their vision is different, but in practice. So can we interpret this so that also the leaders are practitioners, and they have these ideals, good articulations, but then at the same time, they're practical. Do they have the economic, could I say, need for the customers? Or do they want to show that they're international, but not as ethical as they claim to be? Is this the clear dilemma of internationalization, that we may see it in a superficial way and still claim that we are doing something as higher education institutions, that we are contributing to the global responsibility because we have such a number of international students, while at the same time, in fact, in the interviews, the leader said very clearly that, well, it's the income that is the real issue. And is that clear to students? Is that clear maybe to their donors of these community colleges? They depend on external funding and donations as well, not only fees from the students. And how do people function within this dilemma, paradoxes, as we call them? How can they live with that? Did that come in the interviews? The findings are clear, but does this living with the paradoxes sort of as an emotional reaction, does it come in the interviews? Was there any sort of sign of?
No, I don't. In the U.S. Case, I did not observe recognition of the paradoxes. And I think that was the important piece, is that I think there is a cognitive dissonance that they simply are not aware of. And so that's, I believe, the place of this work is to highlight and identify that this is a dissonance. And in doing so, ideally administrative actors can draw on this type of research to facilitate conversations that will lead to more ethical approaches. And I think that we paint it's a problematic picture to say that they're dependent on these international student like funds from international students. Because they weren't in the past, and maybe now they have become dependent on these funds, but that was a choice, like a purposeful strategy. So I think that we don't want to paint it as if it's something that was unavoidable. I think that it was avoidable, and their cognitive dissonance did not allow them to avoid it. Now they are already in the situation, and given that they're in this situation, they have a responsibility to fix the problem that they have created.
And I think the same question is still valid even in relation to Finnish higher education institutions who are seeking new ways of finding income. And international students are seen as customers, and the neoliberal discourse, I think, is still very strong even here. And then I think something that you mentioned here is also this different perspectives when we have this critical, liminal, and soft critique, and then issue that is not within the scope of this research is actually decision makers. These people that you interviewed are leaders and they are administrative actors, but they are not actually the decision makers, except for maybe the implementation, but maybe not for the policies of their institutions. How can this kind of research or findings reach those who actually do decide on higher education policies? No, I'm asking you as a research activist in a way, because as our colleague Juha Suorant has mentioned, there's also a term called research activism. And this is how I perceived your lecture today as well. It's closer to something that I would call research activism. How would you inform those who actually do decide on higher education policies?
I would say I would be careful in taking agency away from the administrative actors. I think that they have agency to decide some things that they choose not to do. And when we take away that agency, it makes it easier to ignore our responsibilities. And so that's what I tried to highlight in this work, is that everyone at all levels has a responsibility to do something. And in doing something, that is how you reach others who are able to make the final decision. But as I said in my speech, it is getting into good trouble. So recognizing that the system is facilitating injustice, recognizing that you are being expected to facilitate injustice, and then acting in a way that will not be necessarily pleasing to your superiors, just enough not to get fired, because then you wouldn't be able to continue the work. So walking the tightrope.
Yes, I think walking the tightrope is certainly, I think, the term to be used here. People still are afraid for their jobs and their own positions and situations, sometimes for their lives, when it comes to political activism, even within higher education. And I mean now really policy as such, as promoting maybe the global common good that, as Marjiton has defined. You also mentioned here that you do recommend Finland, for instance, as maybe one example in the world, to formally institutionalize global responsibility within higher education. And how could that be done? Now that you've been listening to the administrators, would they be willing to do that if that would be institutionalized? And what does institutionalization mean in practice?
Well, here we're going to start to speak beyond my data, because I can only say what they have said to me. And But what has been said to me is that if the government formally institutionalizes global responsibility and connects funding mechanisms to global responsibility, then it would be something that they could pursue. But without those funding mechanisms, they feel paralyzed to pursue global responsibility because other things do have funding mechanisms attached to them. And as I say, that in and itself, these funding mechanisms, that's rather neoliberal. So this is the tightrope of neoliberalism as well. But as I say, I think that we can engage in globally responsible behavior through collective action without having to have funding mechanisms attached to that. But if we're asking, you know, what is the solution that has been presented to me, that is the solution from the participants.
I would assume that this also concerns funding instruments. What do you think, shouldn't that also then be one item in international rankings? Now it's like international reputation, publications, counting all kinds of products that we produce in higher education, how many international staff we have, how many international students we have, and how many high-ranking journal articles we have produced. It has nothing to do maybe in practice how global responsibility is enacted on. Should that not be included in international rankings as well?
Well, international rankings are rather neoliberal. So, I mean, that this is the, we can't become paralyzed by these paradoxes. I think that if we turn back to Young's theory, what we see is that she doesn't present solutions through collective action. What she suggests is that you have a responsibility to engage in collective action. And the way that you engage in that collective action, it should be informed and you should attempt to educate yourself. But once you are doing it well informed, then there's no right answer necessarily. You're responsible to the others that are engaging in the collective action with you. So it will depend on the context. So if in Finland you find that is the solution, then that could be a solution. But I am not in a position to say yes or no. That's not the way that it works.
Yes, certainly internationalization is full of paradoxes. And as you mentioned, Young did not offer solutions and did not demand us to offer solutions, but to really discuss and reflect and problematize issues and question. And you have set forward some questions for further research. And if you now look back into your suggestions and you think like what more knowledge do we need in the field of critical internationalization of higher education? How do you then, when you look at back now, you emphasize moral philosophy, you emphasize that essentially this is a moral question. What is internationalization and how we approach it and how we perceive our own roles and positions in it? If you now look back and you look at this social connections model, Young's model that you have often referred to, and you think it is very useful for research on ethics of internationalization, and you would like to, the future research, apply these themes and frames, or even new philosophical frames, to make more direct suggestions for administrative actors. And I think this is actually the strength of the work as well, that you do mention the administrative actors as people also responsible for, even though they may cover themselves behind the shield of, you know, of the whole university, beautiful philosophy, and then they do what they can because then the neoliberal forces are on them as well, demanding them to calculate all kinds of things. But What do you when you now look back, what you have written here, and what you have stated that what we do need is maybe new philosophical frames, or to apply social connections model and this ethical internationalization lens on our efforts. What do you think, what more concretely needs to be done? What are the issues that you would study now? After all this process and the knowledge that you have now?
Yeah, well, as I said in the beginning, most of this was written in 2018, so I've had quite some time to be thinking of where we need to go next. And I think, fortunately, we are making a lot of progress connecting critical race literature to critical internationalization studies literature. Crystal George Mwangi and Christina Yao are doing some excellent work there. And so I think that that's very important. And then, as I say in the dissertation, it's very important to apply this lens in other national contexts as well. As you mentioned, Finland and the US are very privileged, economically affluent countries. And they both exist in the majority world. But what we need is research from the minority world and from scholars and practitioners that exist in those contexts as well.
Would you then agree with Mignolo and De Sousa Santos in that we actually do need also to value different types of knowledges?
Yeah, absolutely. Valuing different types of knowledges, I think, is certainly in line with critical internationalization studies as a field, and something that we continue to work towards building.
And I think what I would like to have is maybe like one last question to you. And we already talk about this knowledge and what we still need. And you also mentioned here that researchers should employ additional theoretical frames and sort of go beyond maybe their own. You mentioned ivory towers, or go beyond the current knowledge and imagine something different. And then I think the issue here is the administrative actors. And I certainly do think that more research needs to be done also on their important role, because they are limited by so many different frames and somehow in between the beautiful policies and the actual practices. And that would be nice to see more research on that and their important role in enacting on the policies and strategies that they do have. But also global injustice. Your theme is global injustice, global social injustice. And we still discuss countries like the US and Finland, like you said, affluent countries. And then at the same time, we are looking at global. The global social injustice is increasing currently because of the pandemic, and is dividing, and apparently the divides are getting bigger. What do you see as a researcher? How do you position yourself in this, as I understood, activism against global social injustice? If it's increasing, has the academia something to do? What is the responsibility we can enact on? How can we promote the scholarship? How can we share the knowledge better than what we have done?
So if I'm understanding your question correctly, you're asking kind of suggestions for the audience in the future.
Yes, and I'm asking especially what is the role of academia in this? The global injustice apparently is not decreasing, it's increasing. And What can we do as academia? And I emphasize the word we, not you.
Yes, I think that it's important to consume critical scholarship. I think predominantly critical scholarship. There are things that, you know, we can learn from other scholarship as well, but we have existed in this frame for a very long time. This frame that is constructed with Western superiority, in which we don't question power. And so we will continue to not question power if we don't purposely seek out knowledge that helps us to learn how to question the assumptions that we don't know that we hold. So as scholars, I think that's an important step, is continuing education. And then as academics in general, supporting critical scholarship, recognizing that our profession is not value neutral. There is no such thing as value neutral. Recognizing democratic racism and teaching, knowing these principles. And I think that is how we can disseminate information to students, which will facilitate, ideally, a more just world, and that people are better able to educate, to be educated. And that goes back to what you're saying with different ways of knowing and presenting knowledge in different ways from different lenses. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. I think I would like to conclude now and provide you my final conclusions on our discussion today. And I think, as I stated in the beginning, I find the thesis extremely timely in the current situation where actually global social injustice is increasing and not decreasing, even though higher education sector is growing. And that may lead us to the questions of the purpose of higher education, that may lead us to the questions as addressed in this dissertation. What are the issues that higher education institutions actually do when they claim, even when they claim that they bear the global responsibility, they are responsible for their students, they are responsible for decreasing global injustice. And the issues of social connection models and Young's extension of that to the global social connection models have been applied here in this research. And the research has succeeded in identifying what are the ethical challenges in higher education institutions from the perspective of administrative actors or leaders who may not be the highest decision makers, but who are still the important middle management, I would call them, in the issues related to enactment on the higher education policies. And as the researcher claims, this research does bring in new information. This level of administrative actors is not much studied. And these ethical considerations are very carefully addressed here, and the ethical challenges from different perspectives. And I think the research does bring into these different ethical dilemmas and paradoxes into the discussion, in the academic discussion. And the complex critical literature review has been extensive. And the methodological considerations are important here. Often we tend to have the assumption, as the doctoral researcher says very clearly, that we aim to have neutrality in our research while we already then forget to position ourselves and explain our foundations. And I value this very careful critical self-reflection on the philosophical foundation and ethical commitments in this research. And this research design has been influenced by colleagues and scholars in the field, which I think is clearly explained here in the report. And in this research, the social justice and global social justice are addressed in terms of internationalization and as internationalization of higher education institutions in selected institutions. And therefore, we certainly cannot generalize the findings, but I think the findings are clearly applicable to the context where the data has been collected. And still, it proposes also questions that need attention in academia, need attention also in decision making. And I think in that way, I find the relevance very high. And I do understand that the issue of asymmetrical representation in higher education institutions is an issue that challenges our international and national cooperation and also our attempts to be inclusive and promote social justice through higher education, as suggested by many scholars already before Tiffany Vigiano. And I think questioning the policies and their implementation is very important. So is also the reflection on the issues from different perspectives and applying different lenses in this. The critical internationalization study of higher education is, I think, an increasing field currently. And we do have more empirical research coming like this one. And at the time of writing this research, the researcher mentions very clearly that we have much more philosophical studies on the ethical internationalization and critical internationalization of higher education studies, while the empirical part has been still lagging. And I think now we have seen more recently, including this study also, that we have more empirical studies as well on the ready to the critical internationalization of higher education, which I welcome very much so. We do need both empirical and philosophical studies in this field. And the key notions here of justice, global social contract and social responsibility, and also global responsibility, I think are very important issues for any higher education institution to reflect on. And I would really very much like to see studies, more empirical studies as this one, and looking into also to the leadership position, decision making, as well as having the students' perspective on the important issue of internationalization. And we have discussed over this examination several questions related to the research, its approaches, and ethical foundations, and especially related to the social justice dilemmas, internationalization paradoxes, and as a doctoral candidate, Tiffany Vigiano has succeeded very well in responding to my questions, and I do recommend the faculty to approve this doctoral dissertation. And with these words, I would like to conclude my statement.
If anyone here has any critical comments to make on my dissertation, please ask the custos for the floor.
As there are no questions asked from Tiffany Vigiano on her dissertation. Kiitän lämpimästi kaikkia osallistujia, etenkin etänä olleita ja paikalla olleita täällä Jyväskylässä seminaarin vanhassa juhlasalissa. Käytän tässä myöskin kustokselle suotua valtaa. Thank you very much for attending this public examination of Tiffany Vigiano's dissertation, both online and here in Jyväskylä, in the old hall of seminarium building. In Finland, the custos is not allowed to or not even expected to interfere with the discussion. This is what I have done, but the kustos is allowed to say something, and this is what I am allowed to say. The public examination is now concluded. You may congratulate the doctor in spe.